It's Aspen Ideas to Go from the Aspen Institute. I'm Trisha Johnson. During the past few decades of his career, the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman has had a lot of opportunities to watch the world shift.
What defines a Promethean moment is the introduction of a new technology or set of ideas that doesn't just change one thing. It requires us to change everything. How we learn, how we govern, how we design, how we do commerce, how we educate, how we fight wars, and how we commit crimes. Yeah, you are here. We are here for a Promethean moment.
Friedman has learned to look at situations from the ground up by being in the middle of the action and talking to the people most affected. And he's learned that to truly understand an issue, you also need to zoom out and see things from multiple dimensions and perspectives. Aspen Ideas to Go brings you compelling conversations presented at the Aspen Ideas Festival. During the closing session of the 2023 festival, Friedman shares some of his biggest fears about the way he's seen the world evolve. But he also shares his biggest hopes for how he thinks we can reunite and put democracy back together. Here's Friedman.
So I've been working on a new book lately, and it's called How to Write a Column. Since we live in an age where everyone wants to be a columnist, I thought I'd actually sit back and reflect on how I learned and how I constructed my narratives and opinions. I don't obviously have a time to go into all the details with you if anyone's looking for the how-to right now, but let me just try to talk mostly about the back half. The first half of the book is literally about how you write a column, and the back half is about what I learned writing a column during the last 40 years. I actually got my start in journalism in high school. I had that teacher who changes your life. In 10th grade of high school, her name was Hattie Steinberg, room 313 at St. Louis Park High School. And her journalism course is the only journalism course I've ever taken. Not because I was that good, but because she was that good. She pounded the fundamentals of journalism into us. She was 62 when I had her. Now that I'm 70 almost, I thought that was quite old. But we used to hang around her classroom like it was the malt shop and she was Wolfman Jack. We were just attracted to her principled and focused way of building fundamentals. I actually got my start writing, though, and I worked on my high school paper and my college paper a little, but I literally got my start in journalism walking down a street in London in 1975 with my then girlfriend, now wife, Anne. And I walked by a newsstand of the Evening Standard, and it had this blaring headline, Carter to Jews, if elected, I promise to fire Dr. K. Jimmy Carter was running for president, and against Gerald Ford. He was trying to win Jewish votes by promising to fire the first ever Jewish Secretary of State. And I have no idea what prompted me, but I said to Ann, look, that's really weird. He's trying to win Jewish votes by promising to fire the first ever Jewish Secretary of State. That's really odd. And I have no idea what possessed me, but I went back to my dorm room and I wrote a column about it. And my then girlfriend, now wife, on Christmas break, took that column home to Des Moines, Iowa, walked it over to the home of Gilbert Cranberg, who is the editor of the editorial page of the Des Moines Register. He liked it. They printed it on a half page of the Des Moines Register with an Outh cartoon, and they paid me $50. And I thought that was the coolest thing in the whole world. I was walking down a street. I had an opinion. I wrote it up, and someone paid me $50. Well, I later finished. I got a degree in Arabic from Oxford. I got hired on Fleet Street in London by UPI. They sent me to Beirut. New York Times hired me. They sent me back to Beirut, then to Jerusalem. Then I was a State Department correspondent, the White House correspondent. I became a columnist in 1995. And I've been doing that ever since. And so one of the things I tried to explore in this book is how I learn, because we all learn differently. And I developed my own way of learning as a columnist. I only understood this 40 years later in retrospect. But the way I learned as a columnist was by going to the edge of three different realms. Because it's at the edge where all the best learning happens. It's at the edge where you get to see things first and name things first. You know, feels a little flat out here. So I went to three different edges. The first edge I went to is the edge of human behavior. I lived in a civil war in Beirut for 4.5 years. And living in a civil war is a unique experience, obviously, but most importantly, from a journalist's point of view, you get to see how human molecules behave at extremely high temperatures in a way you never could growing up as I did in Minneapolis. You get to see what people are capable of for great evil. I wrote about people who shot at the Red Cross in Beirut. And you get to see what people will do in great kindness and humanity under enormously stressful conditions. You get to see the rainbow of humanity in a way you'll never see growing up in Minnesota. Beirut also taught me to be an anthropologist, because in Beirut there was no data. The only data was talking to another human being. And I developed a very anthropological approach to my journalism. I learned that actually talking to other human beings was also data. In fact, it was the most important data. I did confess in my first book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, that living in a town without data and being a wire service reporter was a challenge, because one of my responsibilities was filing the daily weather highlights from Beirut. You know, in those days you went to the paper because you're going to Boston, Bangalore, Bangkok, Beirut. You wanted to know what the high and the low was. And of course, there was no weatherman, so I filed the weather report by saying to my assistant, Ahmed, how did it feel out there today? Oh, Mr. Tom, kind of hot. Around 80, would you say? Ah, yeah. High Beirut 80 today. last night, Ahmed, how did it feel? Oh, Mr. Tom, kind of cool last night. 65, Mr. Tom. Low Beirut 65. And thus was the weather report filed from a city with no data. The second edge I went to was the edge of technology. I developed a habit of going to companies and saying, big companies, global companies, you know, Walmart and AT&T and Infosys and Microsoft, and saying to their CEOs, I'm not interested in your stock price, your quarterly earnings, your annual revenues, or your successor. I just want to do two things. I want to hang out in your research lab. I want to know what's going on at the tip of your spear, because if you want to understand the future, hang around with the people who are inventing it. And I want to hang out in your HR department, your human resources department. I want to know how you're training your people for the future you're inventing. And my intuition was that if it was an important company, that future was coming to a neighborhood near me. So I'm the foreign affairs columnist, but I actually got to know a huge number of HR executives all over the world. That brought me to Bangalore, India in 2004, to a company called Infosys, where I discovered the world is flat. And people forget, I wrote that book 3 years before the iPhone. And it was because 3 years before Facebook, 3 years before Twitter, and it was only because I was hanging out at the edge of the story. The third edge I hung out at was the edge of nature. Anne was on the board of Conservation International for 16 years, and I traveled with her and CI to visit virtually every pristine ecosystem on the planet. The U.S. Navy took me on their ice exercise beneath the Arctic. I got to do some amazing stuff. I did it first to learn about nature, because I didn't know much about nature. And then I did it to learn from nature, because I came to realize that this globalization system I was describing was so complex and intertwined, there was only one thing that mirrored its complexity, and that was the natural world. So if you understood what made for a stable ecosystem in nature, complex adaptive systems with healthy interdependencies, it might give you an insight to what makes for a healthy community in human societies, what I call complex adaptive systems. Hold that thought, we'll revisit it in a second. And so the way I learned my design innovation was to arbitrage all three of those perspectives together. So I'm always looking at the world in 3D. So as I said, I got my graduate degree from Oxford in 1978 in Arabic. I had a classic British Arabist education. If we could grab that version of me and bring him here and say, Tom, what just happened in Syria? That version of me would tell you they just had a coup. It was sort of like when Adib Shishakli overthrew Muhammad Jones in 1954. I'd given you a very one-dimensional answer. If you ask this version of me what happened, this version of me will tell you that Syria had the worst drought in its modern history from 206 to 211. 1 million Syrian farmers and herders left their homes, flocked to the cities, and overwhelmed the infrastructure. Assad did nothing for them. Then they got on these babies and watched the revolution in Tunisia and Egypt, and then they blew the lid off the place. It was the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law all converging to produce a result. So if you're not looking at the world in that kind of 3D as a journalist, you're not going to see it. Now, the second half of the book is about what's the biggest thing I saw. I'm going to go through these quickly. What's the best thing I saw? What's the worst thing I saw? And what's the most hopeful thing I saw in 40 years? Well, the biggest thing I saw is something we're all living through now, and it's what I call a Promethean moment. Prometheus, the Greek deity who steals fire from a closet on Mount Olympus, gives it to humans to build civilization. We know what these Promethean moments are. Printing press, scientific revolution, agriculture revolution, industrial revolution, and this moment we are going through right now. And what defines a Promethean moment is the introduction of a new technology or set of ideas that doesn't just change one thing. It requires us to change everything. How we learn, how we govern, how we design, how we do commerce, how we educate, how we fight wars, and how we commit crimes. Yeah, you are here. We are here for a Promethean moment. You know, when Gutenberg invented the printing press, someone was there, some monk turned to some priest and said, "Now that is really cool." Okay, you mean I don't have to write this Bible out longhand anymore? I mean, we're just going to stamp them out? We are here for a similar moment. Now, how did I come to this conclusion besides just reading the newspapers? I started to notice something that was very obvious, that every political party born of the Industrial Revolution was blowing up. I mean, the Tories became a Brexit party. The liberals in the UK basically disappeared. Their former leader is the spokesman of Facebook today. How weird is that? Labor sort of went Marxist. Republicans became a Trump cult. Democrats are sort of always blowing up. Israel only has elections now. That's all it does. Its founding party has kind of disappeared. France is the only country in the world with a leader without a party and an opposition without a leader. And I have no idea who governs Italy today. But I don't think they're called Christian Democrats anymore. Basically, every political party born of the Industrial Revolution blew up in some way in the last decade. Why is that? Because the Industrial Revolution, I would argue, was such a powerful release of energy. When the Industrial Revolution met capitalism, it took us 100 years to figure out how to govern it. And what we settled on eventually was something called the welfare state. And it had many different versions. There was a Chinese version, a Russian version, East European version, a West European version, social democracy, and an American New Deal version. And what these welfare states all had in common were a set of walls, ceilings, and floors that would enable workers and entrepreneurs to get the best and cushion the worst of the Industrial Revolution. And what left-right politics became was basically a very stable debate about how high the wall should be. Left said high walls of protection, right said low walls. How thick the floor, the safety net should be. Left said thick floor, right said thin floor. And how tight the ceiling should be. The ceiling was on the pace of change. Should be linear or nonlinear. Left said linear, right said nonlinear. And on incomes, left said low ceiling, right said no ceiling. And for 75 years, we had the same left-right debate and the same left-right parties. And then one day, kaboom, there's an energy release that blows off the ceiling, blows down the walls, and crashes through the floor. And what happens is these left-right parties are no longer fit for purpose. And what do parties that aren't fit for purpose do? They fall back on tribalism and culture. We'll talk about that a little more in a second. What was that energy release? That energy release was our Promethean moment. Only unlike the previous Promethean moments built around a single set of ideas or a technology like a steam engine, our Promethean moment is built on two supercycles that are driving it. One is a technology supercycle. It's our ability to sense, digitize, connect, process, learn, share, act, and improve. sense, digitize, process, learn, share, act, and improve with AI. We are putting that cycle into everything from a F-35 fighter jet, which senses its environment, digitizes that sensation, connects that sensation to a processor, learns from it, shares from it, and acts on it. Well, that's going into everything from your watch to your toaster, and soon your own body. That super cycle is an incredible release of energy, but our Promethean moment is unique in one other very important feature. When we went from the printing press to the scientific revolution, we were still in the Holocene climate era. When we went from the ag revolution to the industrial revolution, we were still in the Holocene climate era. What is different about our Promethean moment and is making it so powerful, that release of energy, is that we are going not only into a new technology era, but parallel with it is driving us into a new climate era, the Anthropocene. And that's because another super cycle of emissions, warming, ice melt, extreme weather. These two super cycles converge to blow off the ceiling, blow down the walls, and crash through the floor and create six new governing problems. First, the world became really fast, the pace of change and education problem. We'll talk about that in a second. The world became incredibly fused by climate, migration, and technology. More people today are living outside of their birthplace than any time in modern history. The world became fast, fused, deep. Did you notice? You know, there's no global lexicographer, but you notice how we added the adjective deep to everything? Deep fake, deep mind, deep research, deep medicine. Even made its way into popular culture. The song that won the Oscars a few years ago by Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga was called Shallow. But what was the main verse? I'm off the deep end, watch as I dive in, I'll never reach the ground. Crash through the surface where they can't hurt us. We're far from the shallow now. Oh, baby, we are far from the shallow now. We had to add the adjective deep because technology was going so deep, we couldn't see it anymore. The world got fast, fused, deep, dual. Everything became dual use. Okay, you know, your phone now can call in an airstrike in Ukraine or it can connect you to grandma. Fast, fused, deep, dual, open. One of us can now talk to all of us. And we can hear each other whisper. Yeah, we can hear each other whisper now across the world, and we whisper crazy stuff sometimes. Fast, fused, deep, dual, open, and fragile. Because we connected every node in the world, then we greased the connections between the nodes, and then we took out the buffers. So now instability in one node gets transmitted across the whole system, farther, faster, deeper, cheaper than ever before. Think of the virus that came out of Wuhan. The argument in my book is to govern a fast, fused, deep, dual, open, and fragile world can no longer be done on a right-left grid. It can only be done the way Mother Nature does it. Who survives in Mother Nature, in the natural world, when the climate changes? It's those that can build ecosystems, healthy ecosystems, complex adaptive networks. Who will thrive in our new Promethean moment, which I call the age of acceleration, amplification, and democratization? Never have more people had tools that amplify their human power at an accelerating rate, being democratized with a small d to more people. Who will thrive in our era of these two super cycles? It's those communities that are able to build complex adaptive coalitions where all the elements of the community, business, labor, government, entrepreneurs, philosophers, architects, social entrepreneurs actually collaborate together. That's the world we're going into that will completely blow up left-right politics. I'll give you a very quick example. I'm in Israel, 2019, before the pandemic. I run into Amnon Shashua, who runs Mobileye, the Israeli autonomous driving company that Intel bought for $14 billion a few years ago. $14 billion, because Intel said we want to be a mobility company. Amnon said to me, "Tom, have you ever driven in a self-driving car?" I said, "Amnon, I was just at Google. I drove Waymo's car all over Mountain View." He said, "Mountain View, That's a grid. Try driving in a self-driving car in Jerusalem where there are no two parallel streets. So I came up and I did that. Amazing. Up, down, around, donkeys, camels, Jews, Arabs. Nobody's driving, okay? There's a guy sitting there, but nobody's driving. It tells me an interesting story after. To test a self-driving car in Jerusalem, you need an insurance protocol that determines what constitutes safe self-driving. Otherwise, anything you hit, anyone hits you, you get sued. Well, it turns out that problem is a little deep for the rabbis who run Jerusalem. So what did Amnon do? He convened a complex adaptive coalition of Volkswagen, their car supplier, Mobileye, the rabbis who run Jerusalem, and the Israeli Ministry of Transportation, and they collaboratively wrote the law together. Yandex, Russia's Google, now tests their self-driving cars in Israel. And China just took the whole Israeli law, translated it into Chinese, and made it their law. Here's a quick quiz. Who is left and who is right in that complex adaptive coalition? There is no left and no right. It has to be solved from the center out. And that is the biggest thing I saw in my life, and we're just in the middle of it. What's the best thing I saw? This will surprise a lot of you. I think the best thing that happened in my career, 40 years, was the creation of the European Union. Yeah, I know Americans will do anything for the EU except read about it, okay? But I am here to tell you that a continent that was from time immemorial known for tribal wars between each one of these linguistic groups and religions created the biggest center of free people, free markets, human rights, and the rule of law. We are the first generation of Americans who get the privilege of living in a world with two United States and not just one. And you can't imagine what our world would be like today without the European Union. Say a little prayer for the EU. We are so lucky that we live in a world today of two United States and not just one. That's the best thing I saw. What's the worst thing I saw? Well, I'm going to put it up here, use my little clicker. Skip that. That's a mangrove. Mangroves are amazing plants in nature. That's another mangrove. They're forests basically grow in coastal areas. And mangroves do four incredible things in nature. First of all, because they have these cable roots, they filter toxins and pollutants. In fact, they actually convert salt water into fresh water and then extrude the salt through their leaves. They're amazing inventions of nature. They create nurseries for young fish to grow because their cable roots, larger fish can't get in there. So they're incredible nurseries for young fish against their predators. Mangroves, most importantly, prevent storm surges. So the villages in Indonesia that took out their mangroves got wiped away by the tsunami. Those that didn't were completely protected. And lastly, mangroves hold the ground in place. They anchor a coastline and a community. And the worst thing that happened in my life is that we lost our mangroves. Oh, but not just in nature. You see, shame used to be a mangrove. It used to be that if you had unprotected sex with a porn star 4 months after your wife gave birth to your son, you were out of politics. Shame was a mangrove. We lost that mangrove. Elite responsibility used to be a mangrove. When we had a president back in the 1970s, whose team basically launched an intelligence operation at the Watergate Hotel against the other party, he actually said, "I'm not a crook." He actually was ashamed to be called a crook, and his own party took that elite responsibility and said, "You must leave office." That there were actually things in our society that we defended as absolutely inviolate. Well, on January 6th, Mitch McConnell, the day after, said Donald Trump is responsible for this event, but I'm not going to vote to impeach him. That is a complete failure of elite responsibility, and elite responsibility is a mangrove. Local news was a mangrove. President Obama tells a wonderful story about when he was first running for president, went down to southern Illinois to meet with a local newspaper editor. White guy, conservative. Obama said, I spent an hour with him. After that hour, newspaper editor said, I'm endorsing the black guy. Black guy's okay. I'm endorsing the black guy. That's one way he got elected. Today, that editor is gone. That newspaper is gone. And the message goes right from Tucker Carlson or MSNBC right into your home with no mangrove, no filter. Political parties were a mangrove. They didn't tell you who had to be elected, but they filtered out who was completely inappropriate to be elected. And now that we've moved to a largely primary-driven politics, we lost that mangrove. That's the worst thing that's happened in my life. And I have to tell you, folks, it's pretty bad. We lost our mangroves in nature, in politics, in journalism, and in our society. But I don't want to end this Ideas Festival or my book on a downer. So I'm going to tell you what is actually the most hopeful thing that happened in my life. I discovered that you can actually rebuild a mangrove in nature. It's very hard. You need nature to cure nature. It involves a huge amount of hydraulics, but you can actually create a context of planting mangrove seeds, and you can rebuild a mangrove in nature. And I think we, just as we need nature to cure nature, only democracy can cure democracy. We can actually rebuild our democratic mangroves. And we saw that in the 2022 election, midterm, in the state of Alaska. Okay? What happened in the state of Alaska? Maybe the most conservative state in the country, but right up there. A woman named Lisa Murkowski, independent senator, who had the spine to vote to impeach Donald Trump for January 6th, was reelected as senator. And how did that happen? Is because we rebuilt a political mangrove in Alaska by introducing just two reforms: open primaries and ranked choice voting. Open primary and ranked choice voting. For those of you who don't follow it, it's very simple. Open primary says we're getting rid of the old system. The old system was Democrats running their primary, Republicans running their primary. What does that do? What does that do? It puts all the cheese on the edge because a Republican knows he can only lose to someone to his right. A Democrat knows she can only lose to someone to her left. So we actually created an incentive. These politicians aren't stupid. We set all the cheese on the edge. Well, move the cheese, you move the mouse. So when you get rid of Republican and Democratic primaries and you create an open primary, what happens? Everyone has to worry, I may need a few votes from the other side. So in the Alaska open primary, I got the list here. There were three people who made, they take the top three. Lisa Murkowski got 113,000 votes. Kelly Chewbacca, who is a Trump-endorsed MAGA candidate, got 111,000 votes. And Patricia Chesbro, the Democrat, got 27,000 votes, which shows you what a conservative state this is. So those three went into the election. That was the voting they got in the first round of election. None of them, though, got 50%. But because it was ranked choice voting, where you had to rank 1, 2, 3, all of the Democrats' votes, because it's only the top two are the finalists, were spread out over the other two candidates. And as a result of that, Murkowski won by 53%, and Chewbacca only got 46%. Open primary and ranked choice voting moves all the cheese to the center. We actually can rebuild our political mangroves. It just takes the political will to do it. Now, let me just finish with one last slide, because I really love this story, because it's really related. And it's a perfect, I think, segue from the panel with Daniel before. So the Washington Post recently started a feature, sort of called Happy News. You know, we have news, weather, sports. Now we have to have a special section, you know, just for happy news. And in 2019, they did this amazing story which caught my eye. This is a town called Rogers Forge. It's halfway between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And what happened in this town was that this guy knew his neighbor across the street, a woman, had recently lost her husband. It was time of COVID. She was really sort of depressed and isolated. And he was putting up his Christmas lights before Christmas. And on the spur of the moment, he decided not just to light up his own house, but to string his lights across the telephone pole and light up her house too without asking her. And he left a tin of cookies on her doorstep and then called her up and said, "Look outside," which she did with a big smile. Well, what happened was all the other people on the street in Rogers Forge saw it. They cleaned out Best Buy and everyone hung their Christmas lights horizontally. And that light up in the front said, "Love lives here." What does that remind you of? A mangrove. That's just a human mangrove. Kofi Annan founded a foundation which I really, really like, the title of Extremely Together. Extremely Together. If there's one thing I've learned in my 42 plus years as a journalist about this Promethean moment we are going through, there was no good time for us to go tribal. This is a uniquely bad time. We need to be extremely together to build complex adaptive coalitions to solve a whole new set of challenges. So if you take nothing else from this talk or nothing else from this festival, please remember next Christmas to string your Christmas lights horizontally. Thank you very much.
Thomas Friedman is an author and journalist and has been a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times since 1995. He's reported on U.S. domestic politics and foreign policy, the Middle East, international economics, the environment, biodiversity, and energy. Friedman is the author of 7 books, including From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. Today's show was programmed by the Aspen Ideas Festival team and produced by Natalie Jones and me. Our music is by Wonderly. I'm Tricia Johnson. Thanks for listening.